Prior to the American Revolution, when Patrick Henry stood up and said, "Give me liberty or give me death," he crystallized for all time the critical tension between security of the state and the desire of all people to breathe free. Today's guest has worked to help resolve those tensions at the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and in the White House. He's Timothy Edgar, this week on Story in the Public Square.
Edgar's deep knowledge of cybersecurity, government surveillance, and personal privacy uniquely qualifies him to discuss issues surrounding the ongoing investigations of Russian interference in American democracy. That's been in the news again this week as Republicans and Democrats write FBI memos and the president reacts once more to a story that is not going away.
Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. To my right is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter in American public life. And right now, there is no bigger story than the laws and practices that guide the government's ability to spy on the communications of its own citizens. To help us make sense of all this, we're joined by Timothy Edgar, a senior fellow at the Watson Institute at Brown University, who previously advised the Director of National Intelligence in the administration of President George W. Bush, as well as serving on the National Security Council staff during the Obama administration. So, Tim, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, it's great to be here.
So, these issues are in the news because of the so-called Nunes memo, right? The congressional GOP staff of the House Intelligence Committee drafted a memo sort of really going after the FISA wiretap on a Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page. So let's break this down a little bit for our audience. First of all, what is FISA?
So it's the main law that governs foreign intelligence surveillance. So if you wiretap somebody, if you look at their communications or their emails, you might be doing it because you think they're part of the mob. That would be a different law. But if you think that they are a foreign threat or they have foreign intelligence, terrorism, espionage, involvement by the Russians or foreign powers, you're going to go under the FISA, under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
And so why is this, why is this not just an intelligence matter and they can just surveil who they need to surveil? Why does the government need a warrant?
Well, because they're worried about abuse. They're worried about the kind of abuses we had with J. Edgar Hoover when he wiretapped civil rights leaders, including Martin Luther King Jr. So we set up a law and we set up a special court that sits in Washington, D.C. To review applications from the government to say, we think this person, in the case of Carter Page, we think Carter Page is acting on behalf of the Russian government. We think he's an agent of the Russians, and here's the information that we, you know, believe shows that. And then the court decides whether they've met the legal standard for surveillance.
And it seems like there's one of the important details that's been lost in some of the coverage of this is that there was the initial application for a FISA warrant, which lasts for 90 days.
Right.
And there were three subsequent renewals, including in the Trump administration, where members of the Trump DOJ signed off on renewing this FISA warrant.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that was really, really critical in that memo. They mentioned the acting Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had signed off on the last renewal. And some people thought that was a way of going after Rod Rosenstein. To say, you know, this person can't be trusted. He's not one of the Trump loyalists. He's not one of us. They might have been reading a little bit too much into that part of the memo. I think this was just saying, here are the officials who signed off on this warrant application.
But am I right in thinking that if the government is asking for 90 days continuance of the warrant and the court is saying, yes, there must be something of value that they're getting out of this?
Yes. Essentially, they have to show that they've met the standards again, and that means that there still exists probable cause that the target is an agent of a foreign power, in this case the Russians, and that they're, you know, going to get valuable foreign intelligence information from the surveillance. Again, it's designed to avoid this kind of abusive wiretaps where, you know, back in the Hoover era, you just looked at people because you thought they were suspicious or he thought they were suspicious. Mm-hmm. You want a judge to be signing off on that based on clear legal standards, and that's what was done in the Carter Page case.
So what do you make of the claims by the Trump administration and allies that the Russia investigation has been compromised by political bias? I mean, that really is the narrative underlying the release of the memo.
So I think it's fairly weak to say that the entire investigation is just a witch hunt, or it's just people, you know, in the deep state who dislike Trump. I think that's a huge stretch. However, I do think there are legitimate civil liberties issues in this foreign intelligence investigation, as there always are in foreign intelligence investigations, because they're pretty wide-ranging, and they involve things that, if they're not criminal, you know, might be issues that matter in terms of politics. That's, you know, we don't necessarily trust the government to always get it right when it comes to these kinds of very intrusive powers. So I do think we need to look carefully at the possibility that, you know, they went too far in certain cases involving Trump campaign officials. That's completely possible, and we shouldn't dismiss it just because, you know, we don't like Trump, or we think that, you know, they're going trying to distract us from the main focus of the investigation.
So what would the mechanism be, though, to get to the truth of that matter?
Well, congressional oversight is one of the checks and balances, you know, and in this case we have a pretty extraordinary amount of scrutiny being applied to an ongoing foreign intelligence investigation. I don't think there's ever been a case before this Nunes memo when a Congressional Intelligence Committee looked so carefully at a specific FISA application, made this kind of claim of abuse, and did so in real time. And you know, that raises a lot of questions about whether Nunes is doing the right thing, whether it's interfering with the investigation. So, you know, but that is one of the checks and balances to prevent abuse.
Do you have any thoughts about the way the media has covered this issue so far? Have they gotten it right?
I think they've... You know, it's hard to explain because it's a complicated issue. I think it's hard sometimes for people in our polarized media environment to have two ideas in their head at the same time. One idea is it's a very serious matter, the Russian interference in our political process in 2016. It appears that the president is not taking it seriously, and that's really troubling. And at the same time, it might be the case that there are legitimate questions to be asked about the investigation. You can believe all those things at the same time, but the media wants to put us in one camp or another. Either we're on the side of Trump or we're on the side of the deep state. And I don't think that should be the way in which we as Americans look at our most intrusive surveillance authorities.
I look at the night that some of this the Nunes memo was leaked, I, you know, flipped through the three big cable news networks, and I'm struck by the difference in the tone and the tenor of the coverage,
right,
from story to story. There's almost three different news universes out there, depending on whether you're a CNN follower, an MSNBC follower, or a Fox News follower.
Yeah, and I think that's really unhealthy for our democracy. I mean, we should have a fair and independent bipartisan investigation of what happened in 2016. The main focus of that investigation should be, what were the Russians doing? Mm-hmm. What were they up to? And how can we prevent this kind of interference in the future? As a secondary focus, they should look at some of these claims of abuse that Trump and his supporters have made. Those are legitimate points. For example, the leaking of information about Trump officials, which was, you know, pretty unprecedented, actually. And then this issue about the FISA warrant involving Carter Page. We haven't actually gotten to what the claim of abuse was, mm-hmm. which was, the claim is that the Justice Department relied on a politically motivated dossier prepared by Trump's political opponents, first the Republicans and then Hillary Clinton, in order to establish probable cause involving Carter Page. Now, that doesn't trouble me that much because, you know, you can use information that might have a bias if you're trying to get a surveillance warrant. What would be an abuse is if they didn't disclose that to the FISA court. They didn't explain, here's where we got the information and why it might be shaky. So we don't really know how much they disclosed about this to the FISA court. We also don't know what other information they had that showed that Carter Page should be looked at.
Right. And there's, I think there's reporting subsequently now that says that I guess it was in a footnote. That it was a political document.
And this, so this shows, you know, if that's accurate, then these claims are really weak, these claims of abuse, and it's a sad day for the House Intelligence Committee, which is supposed to be conducting fair oversight to protect our civil liberties, if they, you know, basically are making baseless claims. That's what the Democrats we expect to say. We're going to have to wait until their memo is released, assuming the Trump administration allows it to be released, to see both sides of the story here.
So let's let's take the macro view here, and not just on this issue, but a number of issues today in American society, where you have, as Jim was describing, a very polarized society, and not to mention a polarized political system, where you have people who go to their go-to place because they see the news and opinions reflecting and reinforcing their own opinions, where you have social media playing such a huge role in that. I mean, this is an unprecedented confluence of events in history. Is there a way out of that? I mean, these are powerful forces. Media,
sure.
Media is a powerful force.
Well, truth is a powerful force, too, I suppose. I mean, I have to have faith that our democracy can withstand, you know, a new form of media, a new form of technology, social media, and all these pressures we've talked about. But it is troubling. It's very troubling to see these two different universes essentially, you know, clashing in this way. You know, we are accustomed, I think, to having a common set of facts to talk about. And when we don't have that common set of facts, we really can't have a functioning democratic system.
So I'm curious, you know, you've got one of the most interesting D.C. resumes I've ever seen, ACLU to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence as a privacy officer, right?
Yeah.
But you've spent time at that very senior level in the U.S. intelligence community. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about this extreme partisanship that we're seeing now in one of the oversight committees. The Senate Intel Committee seems to still be operating right. Reasonably well, but it seems like the House intelligence community has really degenerated into just partisanship.
It's very corrosive.
And what's the danger?
It's very corrosive. I mean, I talked about checks and balances, and certainly it's healthy to have those tough questions asked, even if they're asked sometimes for partisan reasons. But there has to be some sense that our national security goes beyond people's political party.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly I saw in both the House and Senate and in the intelligence community a general sense that we serve the nation. I came into government from the ACLU to take a job that was a pretty surprising job that I didn't expect to ever be offered, which was to be an inside kind of privacy watchdog looking at some of these big mass surveillance programs that Edward Snowden, the contractor, later revealed. And I came in the George W. Bush administration, but I came in as a civil servant. And when Obama took office, I had this great opportunity to go to the White House and work with colleagues on the National Security Staff. But it's what surprised me is, although there were certainly some changes in terms of the direction and the policy that we expected, you know, between Bush and Obama, there was also a general sense that, you know, we serve the country, we serve the nation. And our job is to provide the president and to provide policymakers with the best intelligence that we can in order to make the right decisions to keep the country safe. And I think that gets lost when you have this back and forth between the White House and the House Intelligence Committee over the objections, by the way, of the FBI and national security agencies. It was almost an end run around the national security agencies, I think, that the Trump White House was able to pull off by having the House Intelligence Committee write this memo, and then it goes to the White House for them to decide whether to object to its release. You avoided the White House having to order the release of information by the FBI, which I think is very corrosive.
This is a great moment for a station break. We're going to do a quick station ID. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program airs three times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can find me at JM Lutis. To my right is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller. He's an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal, and he's also the author of 17 books. He's on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. Our guest this week is Timothy Edgar, a senior fellow at the Watson Institute and director of the Graduate Cybersecurity Program at Brown University, as well as the author of the book Beyond Snowden. You can catch him on Twitter at Timothy_Edgar, spelled just like it sounds. So, Tim, I want to talk about the book, Beyond Snowden, Privacy, Mass Surveillance, and the Struggle to Reform the NSA. For the audience who might not know, what is the National Security Agency and what do they do?
So they're one of the largest intelligence agency in the world. And they've been set up by the the Truman administration essentially to spy on the world's communications and gather intelligence for the U.S. government and for its allies, its very close allies, what are called the Five Eyes, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And so they collect massive amounts of data, they analyze it, and then they produce intelligence reports. And so what I write about in the book is the way in which this interacts with our privacy in the digital age. In an age where borders have become increasingly irrelevant, where it's much more difficult to separate foreign and domestic spying, and it's much more difficult for the government essentially to rely on the old laws they had, those laws that descend all the way back from the 1970s, mm-hmm. that are really based on totally different technology, totally different threats. You had the Soviet Union rather than transnational terrorism, and a totally different society in which our lives were much more bordered. We were much more confined to our own countries, and it was possible to kind of draw a line and say, this big NSA that does all this huge amount of surveillance around the world, we have to worry about some of the privacy that might exist if you have an international phone call, which is pretty rare, but really we're mostly worried about J. Edgar Hoover. We're mostly worried about domestic spying. I wrote this book to talk a lot about how can we protect privacy in a digital age of global mass surveillance.
So I'm a bit of a tech geek, and I think Jim is too. What exactly are the tools of mass surveillance today? What is actually happening
sure.
with the NSA and
sure.
behind so, those walls?
There's a whole bunch of different techniques that they can use, but one of the things we learned from the Snowden revelations, from Edward Snowden's leaks of top secret information back in 2013, is that the NSA scoops up a lot of data in what are called bulk collection operations. So these are collection operations where you get everything that's going across a wire or everything that's in a giant database. You stick it in a big database at Fort Meade where the NSA is headquartered, or way out in Utah where they have a new facility, and then you analyze it later. That presents all sorts of interesting and difficult privacy issues. There's also a big new form of surveillance, which I call transnational surveillance. And that is the NSA can look at data inside the United States belonging to big internet companies, or that's transiting across big pipes that telecommunications companies have, in order to find their foreign targets. But there's a lot of American data in there as well, because our data is mingled together in ways that before the internet it wasn't. And that creates all sorts of difficult legal and privacy issues. That's a part of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that's not about individual orders like we were talking about with Carter Page, mm-hmm. but about these big program mass surveillance orders. Congress just debated this a couple of weeks ago and renewed that authority for another 6 years.
So we're talking about what exactly in terms of digitalia? We're talking texts? Are we talking
yes.
emails? Are we talking Facebook? Are we talking Twitter? All of the above and more?
All of the above and more. You're talking about any kind of digital data that could be collected with the assistance of an American company, could be obtained under this provision. You can't target individual Americans under that the way that you could with an ordinary FISA warrant, but you can target on a very, very low standard virtually any foreign target overseas, and then if there are communications that you or I might be having with that foreign target, they would then be collected by the NSA. So this obviously poses serious privacy concerns, and it's one of the things that Congress was debating just this past month.
So, I mean, when you talk just Facebook and Twitter alone, whether you're up to something nefarious or not, many people share things there without a second thought. I mean, it's just
yeah.
become like, okay, I get up in the morning and I have a thought, or I did this or whatever.
Here's what I had for breakfast.
Here's what I had for breakfast,
yeah.
all the way up to I want to blow someone up in Times Square. Boom, it's out there.
To be clear, you know, with the social media world, we're actually talking about something called open source intelligence, where you don't need any court order because it's publicly
right.
available.
And would that apply to Facebook and Twitter?
If yes, although there are questions about whether government agents can pose as somebody that they're not in order to become part of somebody's friends, for example.
But they can comb through.
Sure. They can certainly look at anything that's publicly available for valid intelligence purposes. That was one of the issues we looked at when I was in government, and frankly, the issues were quite difficult. Because you don't want to stop agents from, you know, reading the newspaper or looking at what people are posting online for the world to see in order to detect threats, but you also want to avoid the possibilities of abuse.
So isn't there an argument, though, that says that, look, all of this data is flowing over American networks, and we live in a post 9/11 world where there are bad guys who want to do terrible things. And if we have access to this information and another attack happens and we weren't exploiting that information that was in our own networks, we're derelict. We're letting down the American public.
I think that absolutely is a good argument, and it's a compelling argument. And it's the reason that Congress, way back in 2007, created this authority in the first place, by the way, with then-Senator Obama's vote mm-hmm. and support. The question has been, how do you control that? How do you control that kind of mass surveillance operation? I have a number of ideas in my book about beefing up our oversight. You know, this FISA court we talked about, this court that's set up to look at individual surveillance applications, did a pretty good job of doing that. It's set up to do that because that's what judges are familiar with. Judges really aren't very familiar with overseeing vast surveillance programs. So I put in a lot of ideas about how we could beef up that oversight, how we could give more technical experts to the FISA judges to advise them, how we can give them more control back into this kind of world of mass surveillance.
Is this analogy apt? So in a case like the FISA application on Carter Page, we know the needle that we're looking for, we know what haystack he's in, and we're going to target very specifically his communications. But with this mass surveillance, we're basically talking about Hoover vacuum cleaning up all of the digital communications that's flowing across networks, and then using massive computers to sift through it to find stuff that meets our targets. We're looking for the hidden terrorist or hidden spy as opposed to the person that we have already reason to suspect might be up to something.
That's part of it. There's sort of something in between those two extremes. What you're describing in the second case we would call bulk collection. Mm-hmm. You can't actually do that inside the United States. You can do it outside the United States. But you can do something in the middle, the transnational surveillance I was talking about. You have targets in mind, but you don't have the kind of individual probable cause suspicion that we had for Carter Page. But you think these people are outside the country. So you go to Google, you go to Facebook, you go to Yahoo, and you serve them with this order, and you say, here's our list of targets, give us all their information. That's essentially what's done under this sort of middle ground of those two extremes.
So I want to approach this from a different angle. I was in New York City for a week, 4 weeks after 9/11. And as you can imagine, it was a time of great fear and paranoia. And many of the conversations were grim. And many of them had to do with the fact that if this happened once, it could happen again. And the reality is, since 9/11, there has been nothing of that scale on domestic soil, nothing even remotely close. So does mass surveillance get some of the credit for having helped prevent something similar, something massive and horrible like that?
I think it does get some of that credit. If you look at some of the surveillance authorities that I talk about in the book, they were used over the course of the past decade and a half or more to thwart particular terrorist plots. Now, you don't want to overstate this. There are certain kinds of programs that after the Snowden revelations came out, because of the transparency and the sunlight that went in, they said, hey, this program was really intrusive. It didn't actually help that much. Other programs, the one we just talked about, where the case is much stronger. But certainly intelligence is our best line of defense against terrorism and other transnational threats. And so one thing I find fascinating about this topic is that you really can't have absolutism here. I mean, you can be a strong civil libertarian, and I consider myself, I mean, I worked at the ACLU, I consider myself very much a supporter of the ACLU. But you don't believe in, never surveil anybody ever. It's a question of balance, and it's a question of what are the standards and rules you have to collect information, and how do you draw that line? And we've had real challenges in the past of how to do that.
It seems to me like this is a critical tension that has vexed Democratic governments across history, right?
That's right.
That balance between liberty and security.
That's right. And we have a very specific and unique history in the United States when it comes to this. You know, our Revolutionary War was fought in part because we were worried about privacy, about warrants,
Search and seizure.
Search and seizure. We have the Gatsby affair in Rhode Island. We have the Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party up in Boston. These were all complaints by the colonists of, hey, the British shouldn't have these kind of broad powers to search and seize anything they want to. So we need to have something like a warrant procedure to limit the government. And when we talk about intelligence in the 21st century, one of those big tensions is, you know, do you always have to have a warrant? Do you sometimes have to have a warrant? If you're doing these broader operations, how do you control them?
We all remember very vividly when Snowden, Edward Snowden, leaked what he leaked and then disappeared, and I guess he's still in Russia somewhere, wherever he is. And there was an intense debate then, and I guess it would still continue today, as to whether he was a hero for what he had done or a villain for what he was, had done. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts about that. Was he one or the other, a little of both, black and white, or what are we looking at?
You know, I think most thoughtful people reject the most extreme characterizations of Edward Snowden as either a hero or as simply a traitor and a villain. You know, I think his actions were reckless. I think his actions did cause damage to national security, but they also gave us an opportunity to have a conversation about global mass surveillance. And that opportunity resulted in significant reforms over the next few years that I talk about in the book. So I think on balancing, you know, even people in the intelligence community recognize the value of the reforms that were made after Snowden. If you look, for example, at the Attorney General Eric Holder, former Attorney General under the Obama administration, he actually described what Snowden did as a public service. He got a lot of heat for that characterization, but it was what I've been hearing privately from many of my friends in the intelligence community. They said, you know, we don't like Snowden, we don't like what he did, but we really do value being able to have greater legitimacy for what we're doing that we get from having the debate, because many of those programs were kept. Many of those programs, you know, were looked at in the public eye, and the government essentially and the Congress said, yeah, actually we want to do this, maybe with some additional privacy safeguards.
We need to leave it there, but it's a great conversation. He's Timothy Edgar. The book is Beyond Snowden. Thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can always catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can visit PellCenter.org, where you can also find previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.